listening to By the Well. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. And this week we're focusing on Genesis 25 verses 19 to 34, Romans 8 verses 1 to 11, and Matthew 13, starting to look at the parables there, verses 1 to 9 and 18 to 23. Robin, Genesis 25, where are we up to with the Genesis narrative?
So we've skipped a couple of chapters and we're well into the second generation now, about to move to the third really. Isaac has just married Rebecca at the start of our story, and you might remember from last week's lectionary reading, if you've been following Genesis, that there was a long story of Abraham sending a servant back to his homeland to find a wife for his son Isaac. He was determined Isaac not marry a Canaanite.
Mm-hmm.
Now we meet Isaac having married Rebecca in this story, and it's ultimately the story around the birth of their twin boys, Esau and Jacob. So scholars refer to this as the start of the Jacob cycle, because Jacob will be the prominent character going forward over the next few weeks. And if you haven't been preaching on Genesis, it's maybe a good place to start again, as there's a bit of a compact story in the next few weeks with Jacob.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So if you were to preach on it, Robin, what are some things that stand out from the chapter before us, chapter 25, that you would think need bringing to the fore?
There's lots of themes here, and again, the issue for a preacher will be picking one or two, and unless you're doing, I think with some of these Old Testament stories, there's something to be said for telling the story as much as anything.
And this is not telling people how to suck eggs, but actually the children's time, if you've got one in your community, is a good place to do that.
Yes, to draw out this story.
Yeah, and rehash it a bit for people. Yeah.
Yeah, bring it alive. I mean, I was preaching at a parish recently where there's a religious education teacher in the congregation, and she said whenever she teaches Genesis to her students, they love it because it feels like a soap opera. And this
Indeed.
Feels like a soap opera.
It does. It's got all sorts of drama.
Yeah. So to your question around themes, we've got another barren woman, Rebecca here. Mm. Again, pre-scientific age, where if a woman couldn't have a baby, it meant there was something wrong with her womb, not ever the man. And Isaac pleads to God, and God gives them these twins.
That part of the story is quite quickly dealt with, though, isn't it?
It is. I think it's not really the main point.
No.
But it's reinforcing this pattern that we're going to get time and time again of, you know, Sarah struggling to conceive.
Remarkable or impossible births.
Yeah, unlikely or impossible births. And the other theme that we get here that we've already met is we're going to get younger sons who take the place, the traditional place of the older son. So Isaac does this with Ishmael, and Jacob is the younger son, but he's going to come out on top as the inheritor of this Abrahamic covenant.
So we see, you know, in simple sort of terms, God really turning on, turning the logic we have about the order of things on its head.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is one of the theological themes that comes throughout Genesis and beyond.
God chooses so-called weakness, I suppose.
Yeah. The unlikely leader and all of that. There's wonderful plays on words here. So Esau comes out as a twin. They're already struggling in the womb, and we get this rather eerie prophetic word in verse 23 that there's two nations in her womb. They're already battling for power. So power and, you know, inheritance, these themes are running throughout here.
And division.
Mm. Yeah. Again, we've already had two nations split from Abraham. There's the Ishmael, who will go on to be the father of what we now know as the Islamic nation, and Isaac, who's father of the Jews. We're going to get two more nations here. Esau will be associated with Edom or the Edomites, and that's a play on words. He comes out red and hairy. He's named Esau, which means hairy, but the redness is important because redness is this word Edom, and he's going to trade his birthright for red stew. So the colour is important. So it's a bit of an etiological tale that explains why Esau and his people became known as the Edomites, literally the kind of red people, if you like, and they have their area to the east of Israel.
The writer had fun with that, I'm thinking.
Yeah. There's a sense, I mean, these stories, of course, are always written down later, sometimes much later. So there's a sense of a kind of a looking back and giving a narrative that explains the way the world is.
Yes, yeah.
Jacob is also got an important name. His name means supplanter or heel because he comes out grabbing his twin by the heel. He'll be this sort of quiet achiever in a sense. And I think the real point of the story and the way it's edited and framed here is that Esau comes in from the field. He's hungry. Jacob's made some stew and he says, basically, give me some stew. And Jacob sees an opportunity. So Jacob's a little bit of a trickster in a number of these stories.
A player, as we say, a bit of a player.
Sees an opportunity. He's got a hungry older brother here and says, well, you can have some stew if you sell me your birthright. Mm. And Esau basically does. I mean, there's this quite dramatic line. You can imagine a teenage boy going, what the point is a birthright if I'm going to die of hunger? Mm. And it ends with this line, you know, and so Esau spurned his birthright. So there's this, you know, we have this text from the perspective of Jacob that Esau is the one who gave up his birthright.
Oh, right. It's a bit self-justifying rationale there.
It is. We're going to see the conflict continue, though, next week and the favourites and the tension that comes from all of that. So it's a very human story.
Yeah. To me, it really does underline what we hear repeatedly in the Gospels, and this being the Hebrew Scriptures, though, is that God chooses the frail and the broken and the inadequate to bring forth God's promise.
And that, it is, yep.
You know, they're not only not particularly special, they're downright not very nice, some of them.
Yes, and sometimes get there by being tricky and deceitful. I mean, Abraham did that way back in Genesis with at various times telling foreign leaders that Sarah, his wife, was his sister. You know, there's, and maybe there's a link here to Romans if we move on.
We get a lot of sin in Romans. We do. I was just thinking that too because I think Paul is quite realistic about human nature. In this passage, which I'll come to a bit more in a minute, but chapter 8's really a positive spin on the liberation of life in the spirit. He's dealt in chapter 7 with what it is to dwell in sin. But I think overall Paul's quite realistic about human nature and that in chapter 7 too he talks about us not doing what we want to do but doing what we would not want to do. You know, we sort of had this incapacity to do the right thing that repeats itself.
Yes, we can't help ourselves sometimes. No. Yep.
And I was reading, actually, this is related, but I was reading one of Terry Eagleton's books. He's a literary theorist, but a scholar who also writes about the Christian faith and in particular in conversation with the new atheists. And one of the things Eagleton says about Christianity is how realistic it is about human nature compared to the naive optimism he perceives in new atheist philosophers who seem to him to have huge faith in human progress he sees a lot of hubris in that and not a lot borne out in history that we actually are good at the core a lot of the time.
I think that's worth repeating to contemporary Christians because so often we've equated sort of public Christianity, if you like, or perhaps where Christianity has become the dominant religion in Western countries, it's become equated with a certain kind of being a good citizen, being a nice, upright, moral person. But actually being a Christian is simply being someone who's aware of your own sinfulness and need for God's grace and forgiveness.
Yeah.
And so I find great comfort in both Paul and these Hebrew Bible readings that remind us that God can use all sorts of very broken people.
And that, we won't jump ahead to this yet, but that God doesn't, what God can do doesn't rely on us being good.
Yes.
That God can work through us.
Work despite it.
Yeah, despite it.
So what do we need to know about Romans 8 if people were going to preach here, Fred?
Yes. I suppose I'd want to say for those who might have avoided preaching on Paul's epistles or on Romans in particular or have done so only cursorily for a while, and that would have been me too at periods in ministry, I think, a really good book to get to read to get you back into it is Beverly Roberts Gaventa's book, When in Romans. It's not long, but I think she's really helpful in reminding you this is not a theoretical essay that Paul put together perversely to make things difficult, that actually it's a document written to a particular community with particular issues and questions. It was delivered by a woman called Phoebe and probably read out by her to the community.
And maybe even interpreted by her if people had questions. Yep.
Yeah, indeed. So I think that's, if you're going to go into Romans and you haven't for a while or you feel perhaps not up to it, this book's a really good way in.
I agree. It's a wonderful book. And I'm not a Pauline scholar, and so I find Romans dense and hard at times. And reading Beverly Gaventa's book, there were so many moments where I went, oh, that makes sense. Thank you.
I think one of her more helpful points is when she talks about what Paul means by salvation.
Mm.
And she goes through very briefly theological traditions in the church, which have begun perhaps with very individualistic understandings that Jesus, you know, that reading Paul as if Jesus just died for me or for you.
Mm.
And then development in a more complicated way that, no, actually it's communal. She critiques those as being very linear understandings that, you know, we did something wrong either individually or communally and God fixed it up.
Yeah.
But actually what Paul's doing is much more nuanced and radical than that, that the salvation is utterly cosmic. It is not focused just on human beings at all. Mm. And that the way Paul talks about dwelling in sin and indeed living in the spirit, which is what this chapter 8 is about, that sin very much continues, the powers of evil and sin continue in this age. Like, we live in the spirit as Christians who profess faith in Jesus Christ and we're baptized. We live in the spirit and life is different, but the evil and those other things that seek our allegiance are very much still there.
Yeah, I agree entirely. In fact, I would go as far as to say that salvation in the entire New Testament and, well, in fact, in the entire Bible is never individual. It's the salvation of the world. Now, that doesn't mean it's not personal.
No.
But we've confused the personal with the individual and making it all about me and my personal sin.
Mm.
And that means we miss some things here.
And also that it's not all done with. You know, that linear thing is very simplistic too.
It
was a problem, God fixed it, now we're okay. Well, actually that's not how reality bears itself out. And what Paul says too is that, so these powers of evil and sin we can see around us, they're still there. But what God has done in Christ is enough.
Yeah.
And that is the faith we live in, and that's the hope. But to get to the actual passage at hand.
Yes, some details.
So I've already indicated chapter 8's what Brendan Byrne, scholar Brendan Byrne, would say is a turn to the ethical possibility from chapter 7, which has been about the reality and the incapacity we therefore have of dwelling in sin. This is the possible, the ethical possibility. I suppose we need to talk, don't we, about the terminology here.
Yeah, there's one really important word and that's flesh. Well, it's important to be understood correctly because Paul uses two words to refer to our bodies.
Mm.
There's flesh and there's body, which is sarx and soma.
Soma, yeah.
And soma or body, usually translated body if you're using an NRSV translation, is a kind of a neutral space. It's simply your physical, the wholeness of your physical and spiritual being. But flesh for Paul, and this passage is full of flesh, sarx, is bad. Flesh is your physical desires, your kind of,
Well, I think I'd put it, this gets to back to my comments about how realistic he is about human nature, that flesh, that term, I think, describes our human propensity to choose that which puts us first.
Yeah.
Rather than what
sort of selfish desire.
Selfish, but putting anything except for God as number one.
But I think for preachers, if you are going to preach on Romans, it's really important to actually unpack some of that because I worry that it gets heard as an anti-body text.
I'm sure it does.
Or an anti-material text. And Paul's not anti-material at all.
No, and gets into sexual sort of overtones in moralistic ways, which is not at all what's happening
here. No, it's
here.
A much fuller picture than
it's
that.
It's not just, So I think that sort of terminology needs to be straightened out here. But also what Paul means by in Christ. What is this new reality that we're in? What is the liberation? What does he mean by in Christ?
What do you think he means, Fran?
Well, it's almost like there's this sort of sphere of influence or this location where we all are by virtue of our humanity, but also by our profession of faith.
Mm.
That means we are in Christ, which I think for Paul also is you can't distinguish that from being in the Spirit. They're the same thing.
Yes. I quite like verse 6 where he talks about setting your mind. So if you set your mind on flesh, that's death. That's your kind of selfish personal desires that are anti-God. But to set your mind on the Spirit is life and peace. So some of this is about a mindset, or to use a very contemporary term, a certain kind of mindfulness, but in terms of a where you put your energies and where you put your focus will lead you to certain ends, I think.
So I think I'm asking this with a question, Robin, but I want the answer to be yes. But that there's there's an indicative and an imperative in his use of in Christ. So it's actually an objective reality.
Yeah.
God has come and done this in God's Son and given God's Son and raised him from the dead. Sort of whether you like it or not, that is the reality. And whether you like it or not, you are absorbed into that liberation and what that offers. So that's the indicative, but there is this imperative that you therefore do as you live that. You live in response that's true.
Yes, that's right. That's the response part of grace in all of Paul's stuff. No, I agree with that. Pauline scholars elsewhere might be rolling their eyes they're not in the room. So
they might
not
be listening. So there's some of the key points to think. I mean, you could preach several sermons on this passage.
You could, and it is, I will acknowledge it's not easy to preach on some of these Pauline epistles, but I think it's worth the attempt because of the theological richness here.
And not just to move. So in a couple of weeks we'll have the familiar one about nothing dividing us from Christ, nothing can get. And we hear that one a lot, particularly at funerals, and for good reason. But I do think it's important to know where that sits, to hear some of this stuff beforehand and explore it a bit.
Yeah. Matthew. So we're at the start of chapter 13 in Matthew, and the first time early in this chapter, in verse 3, I think, the word parable is used for the first time in this gospel, and we're going to now hear a bunch of parables over the weeks ahead. Any advice for preaching parables, Fran?
Well, not personally, but again, Ben Myers, who's come to our rescue once before, and I don't know, maybe I've mentioned these parable preaching them, rules for preaching parables. I don't think I have though. So Ben wrote 10 rules for preaching parables that he says, look, even he obeys them in the breach rather than, Number one, don't assume that God is necessarily one of the characters in the parable. Number two, don't assume that the parable is trying to tell you how to improve your life. Really important rule, which we'll get to with this first parable in Matthew, I think. Don't assume that you're the goodie in the story and that the other people are the baddies.
Also important.
And so on. I won't read them all now. Number 7. If you feel perfectly confident and untroubled while expounding the parable, you're probably doing it wrong.
I think you could say that by most of the Bible, really.
Yeah. And it's number 10, which is a liberating grace that we live in. Finally, if you've preached a lousy sermon, just remember, as long as the parable was read aloud before you started, it won't be a total loss. So on that note,
let's look at chapter 13. And our lectionary has given us two chunks of text and omitted what are some hard verses in between. So one thing I might suggest if you're going to preach focusing on the Matthew reading is you could just read the first 9 verses, which are the parable itself, and maybe preach on them or whatever your reflective exercise might be in your congregational practice. Let that resonate, because the second part of the reading from 18 to 23 is then Jesus' interpretation.
Or Matthew's.
Or, yes. So Fran and I, and when we get Jesus' fairly allegorical interpretation both this week and next, there is a dilemma. Is this Jesus something Jesus actually said, or is this Matthew very clearly interpreting it for us?
In a way that I think, if I, am able, betrays what a parable is. I mean, to say there's one thing,
Yes, and that's my hesitancy with it too, except I think that to say, well, this is Matthew's hand can allow us to dismiss it as well. So we've got to kind of sit with what we have.
One thing, if I recall, Brendan Byrne saying was that for Matthew, the fact that Jesus taught in parables is more important than the content.
Hmm. So parables are...
Yeah, what are they?
Well, it's quite a Jewish form of address, but it's found the similarities in other cultures. In a sense, it's using indirect communication to communicate something profound that's hard to put normal words around. So using very simple everyday symbols here, and next week we have sowing, seed, growing, harvest symbols.
It can also be an enigma. Though,
yes, they can puzzle. Have a puzzle or a twist in them.
Yeah, or a shock.
I think they're supposed to evoke our imagination. So they're using something familiar but to communicate something that's perhaps unfamiliar, and that's where the twist and the puzzle can be. But the one word of warning I would have, and I don't know if this is in any of Ben's 10 tweets or 10 rules, is don't turn them into fables that have a lesson. So this is the moralizing
turn,
right?
I think
that
might be the one about not saying it's about improving your life.
Yeah. So if we make all of them about this parable means X, we've reduced it to one thing, and I think actually they're supposed to be a bit more playful than that. So what goes on in this one?
Well,
we have a sower.
We have a sower.
Who we shall resist recognizing it as a certain character. Just a
no,
sower.
No, well, for the moment we will, but then maybe in a moment we'll. So the sower sows liberally.
Yes.
With no
aim.
Well, aim and also concern for how many seeds there are.
Well, that's right. So if we assume seeds are precious and expensive.
We can't, well, maybe they
this
weren't.
Is either a very generous sower or actually just quite bad at sowing.
Yeah.
We might think. And we have four locations where the seed falls.
So, yes, rocky ground or a thorns.
Road. Yep.
Or good soil.
Or a road, yeah.
Or a road, sorry, missed the road.
So three out of the four will ultimately not bear fruit. Hence the question about how good this sower is at sowing. But it also, Warren Carter in his commentary points out that this is kind of an image of a subsistence farmer, like an individual farmer probably just growing enough stuff for the family and working with whatever land he has, which might not be ideal farmland.
Right, so it's operating at the level of, at that simple level, I use that inverted commas.
Yeah.
But then also at the level of whether you hear Jesus and also whether you understand Jesus.
Yeah, so each of these become a metaphor for how the word is received in Jesus' interpretation.
So I suppose what we're used to hearing with this parable is often quite a moralistic thing, which is try to be good soil.
Yes, so that you can produce
fruit.
Yeah,
and I'm reminded of Ian Paul's funny phrase, it might have been Frank Rees, that we need to be careful about the hardening of the arteries when preaching on this text, that is turning into you ought to do this and you ought to do that, which is not good news. And this is where we bend one of Ben's rules, where we might say, well, if we don't want to look at it from the point of view of the soil and whether we're good enough or not, what about hearing the story from the point of view of the sower? And the sower is, as we've said, liberally, I mean, being God, which that's breaking
recklessly.
Ben's, recklessly. God is capable of, well, throwing the seed anywhere and doing, able to do remarkable things, bring life, despite the fact that we're bad soil.
Yeah.
So God's capacities is not measured by whether or not we're good enough. Because that's not good news.
No, that's not good news. So I think, and I want to resist saying God, although I think it could be a way of Jesus actually talking about himself and his ministry, that Jesus is someone who's out there spreading the word. Because we've got to remember we've come in here at the end of chapter, you know, beginning of 13, end of chapter 12, we've had more ministry. Jesus has faced rejection, hostility, scoffing, as well as gathering disciples. Mm. So every scenario in this of the word being snatched away by the birds and
is what's happening,
received with joy but then ultimately falling away when it gets hard. Those are all things we've just seen in Jesus' ministry. Yeah. And yet he keeps preaching wherever he goes. So there is a generosity in the
persistence.
Ongoing. Yeah. So I think, so for me, the good news is in two places. It's in this reckless generosity of spreading the word, even to those who might ultimately reject it or find it too hard or whatever the scenario is. But the harvest itself is also incredibly abundant. This hundredfold, 60-fold, 30-fold, maybe not by our commercial genetically modified standards today, but to plant something that comes back hundredfold or 60-fold or 30 is a pretty good year. Huge abundance, yeah.
I mean, the other good news too is that the kingdom has dawned in Christ who is doing this.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, it's happening.
It's happening.
Yes. So I think there's lots of good news. There is both a pointing to the theological abundance and grace that comes in Christ, along with a pointing to the just the harsh reality that you could be out there doing this mission or Jesus work like Jesus and his disciples have at this point in the gospel and be constantly confronted with various setbacks.
So it's very pastoral parable to those communities as well as being a window into how God works and the kingdom dawns.
Yeah, if I could finish perhaps with a word from Bill Loder's lectionary comment. He writes that, you know, at one level, the parable on Jesus' lips may have been asserting that despite appearances or setbacks, God's kingdom would come and would surprise us with its overwhelmingly rich harvest.
You've been listening to By the Well, a podcast made with the support of Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. Thanks for listening.